Well, good evening, and thank you again for joining us for another CAF fighter who is the author of the book Shot Down, the true story of the B-17, the Susan Ruth. And we'll talk more about the airplane and its crew and some other wonderful life experiences that Steve has had in the past few years after he's completed his book. If you have any questions during the presentation, just jot them down in the chat box, and we'll save time at the end to get those questions answered. And right now, joining me from sunny Arizona, where it's always nice and warm, Steve Snyder. Good evening, Steve, and welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Appreciate the invitation.
All right. So let's kick things off.
As I said, I'm delighted to be here. I hope a lot of people are tuning in. I'm on the board of directors and past president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association. And our mission is to remember, honor, and educate. Remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and to educate the public about it, especially younger generations. And that's what the goal of my presentation is, to do those three things. I have about 70 slides. I go through them pretty quickly. The presentation's about 45 minutes. So I hope you enjoy it. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. He flew bombing missions over Europe. And in February of 1944, his plane was shot down. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and made it back to England. It wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. At that time, I had no intention of writing a book whatsoever. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it, learn more. And two items were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting. It's in the book. It was The Mighty Eighth, written by Gerald Astor. It was about the 8th Air Force who flew bombing missions over Europe during World War II. The goal was to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The 8th Air Force got its moniker, the Mighty Eighth, by the noted historian Roger Freeman, because of the number of planes they could put up on missions during a mission. It numbered into the hundreds, and on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin. And I don't know about you out there, but I get excited if I see one B-17 up in the sky, and I can't imagine what it must have been like. 2,000 flying overhead. The other book was first over Germany. It was about the 306 bomb group, which my dad was in. It was written by Russell Strong, who was a navigator in the 306 bomb group. After the war, he became their historian. The first over Germany was the motto of the 306 bomb group because they were the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England that she had kept. And he was very candid in those letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the air base, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I was just fascinated by reading those letters. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on a quest to find relatives of all my dad's crew and asked them for any information they could give to me, letters, accounts, pictures. I went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. It took me 12 months to actually write the manuscript and another 8 months to get it published. I actually formed my own publishing company to do that, called Sea Breeze Publishing, which is the name of the street that I live on in Southern California. And then I contracted with independent professionals for all the associated services, such as editing, cover design, interior layout, printing the book, fulfillment. And it's done pretty well. It's won over 25 book awards since that time. It has a 5-star rating on Amazon. And it's available in all formats, hardcover, softcover, or paperback, all forms of ebooks like Kindle and even an audiobook. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, what happened afterwards. It's not just about my dad, but it's about what happened to each member of his crew and about all the Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. The book contains a lot of excerpts from letters from members of the crew and relatives of the crew, and makes it very personal. And it also, on the print book, it contains 200 time period photographs. You can visualize everything that you're reading about. But I probably wouldn't have written a book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. On the left side of the screen, you see my dad on the left with Dr. Paul Delahaye. That picture was taken in 1994, the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. Dr. Delahaye, in the mid-80s, formed an organization called the Belgium American Foundation to honor the American servicemen that helped liberate their country. And then on the right side of the screen, you see me with Jacques Lalonde. And both these men were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities that the Nazis committed against their family and friends. And later on in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented that testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that would have been lost forever. So I owe these two men a great debt. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in September of 1940. My dad went into the Army. He was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. At the time, the U.S. military prior to World War II was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Portugal, if you can believe that. Also, they're very ill-equipped, as you can tell by the World War I uniform combat gear that my dad has on there. Well, 3 months later, in July, my dad married Ruth Hempel. They got married at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena, California. My mother was born in Pasadena, and it was right after she attended or graduated, I should say, from UCLA, where she was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. I was also born in Pasadena and also went to UCLA. And when I was there, I was a classmate of Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska. He moved to California right before he started high school in 1929. Well, a few months later, on December 7th, a date which will live in infamy, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was war. It was at war. My mom was very scared at the time, worried about an uncertain future. So she went up to Washington to visit my dad over Christmas. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, my dad at the time was kind of concerned how he's going to support his new family as a new bride, a baby on the way. And he didn't think he could do that very well on Army's pay, private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force. We thought he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 1942, he went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana, California, and then went through the three stages of pilot training. On the left, you have primary. And after primary, if they graduated, they went into basic. And pilot training was really tough. 40% of the cadets that started washed out. And then after basic, they went into advanced training, and that's when the pilots were separated out. They either went into single-engine planes, fighters, or twin-engine planes, which were either transports or bombers. Typically, the shorter pilots went into fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit. But I personally feel that it's also based on personality. You know, it's been my experience anyway. that those fighter pilots tended to be pretty individualistic, have big egos, pretty cocky risk takers, whereas the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. My dad was 6'3", so they put him into to bombers. Here you see my dad in primary flight training at Santa Maria, California. And this was a really proud day for my dad. You can see he's wearing his goggles on top of his helmet, and you could not do that unless you soloed. So that was a big day in my dad's life. You see him smoking. I think most everyone that went in the war smoked back then. Here you see the three planes he flew during pilot training. Up on top in primary is a Stearman biplane. And then in basic, he flew a single wing Vultee Valiant. And then in advanced 20 pilot training, twin engine, that's a Curtiss Wright 18-9. He also flew a Cessna Bobcat. He graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943 in Douglas, Arizona, where he earned his commission as a second lieutenant and got his pilot's wings. And then from there, he went on to transitional crew training in Pio, Texas, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. And then from there, he went on to operational crew training in Galhart, Texas, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. Then once deemed ready, they were assigned to the overseas to the European Theater of Operation. And on October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England. It was located about 60 miles north of London. That's what the base looked at the time. Of course, it's gone now, but there's a nice little museum that contains a lot of artifacts. My wife and I have visited there a couple times. Here you see the insignia of the 306 Bomb Group. In the 8th Air Force, there were three air divisions. The 306 was in the 1st Air Division, which was signified by a triangle. And then each bomb group in the 8th Air Force had a designated letter of the 306 was H. So you have a triangle H. Every bomb group had a, let me back up there for a second. Besides being the first group to hit a target in Germany, the 306 was the longest serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force during World War II. That we got to England in September of 1942, and they didn't come back home until December of 1946. They were involved in the aerial photo mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa in a project called the Casey Jones program. A lot of people probably seen the 1949 movie 12 O'Clock High starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by 3. Another distinction the 306 bomb group had was that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Air Force Commander Ira Ecker to implement a limit on the number of missions these airmen had to fly before they could go back home. And that happened in the April of 1943. And prior to that, there was no mission limit. And the morale of these combat crews was going into the tank because they realized that they would never make it home. They'd either be killed or they'd be shot down and become prisoners of war. Well, Dr. Schuller suggested a mission limit of 20. Ecker decided on 25. But at least it gave these combat crews, some hope that they would get back home and give them a light at the end of the tunnel. Then when Jimmy Doolittle took over command of the 8th Air Force in January of 1946, he eventually raised the mission limit to 30 and then 35. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons. These are the four in the 306 bomb group up in the upper left. You have the Clay Pigeons, so named because they took such devastating losses during the war. And then over on the right, you have the Eager Beavers, and down below, the Grim Reapers, and my dad's squadron, the 369th Fighting Knight. I always like to point out the ground crew. These combat crews, got all the recognition, all the glory, but these ground crews were the ones that really kept these bombers flying. When these birds would come back after a mission, ground crews would stay up all night, usually very inclement weather, repairing battle damage, doing maintenance on the plane, replacing engines, replacing tires. And they took great pride in bombers that they were assigned to take care of. And they really felt that they were their bombers, and they just loaned them out to the combat crews to fly missions now and then. So they were really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew. B-17 had a 10-man crew. There were four officers kneeling down here below. This is my dad on the left, the pilot, the navigator, and the bombardier. Then you had six enlisted men who were non-commissioned officers who were mainly gunners. Five of these men came back, but five of them did not. This is not the Susan Ruth. That's just the plane B-17 that took their picture in front of when they got to England. And I like to point out the nose art. I love the nose art. It's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted or named. The Navy didn't, the Marines didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it would help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes and name them and paint them. And they were very creative, but they not. It was a scantily clad or nude women, because after all, these guys were in their late teens and early 20s, and real young men. 306 Bomb Group, being in the 1st Air Division, flew B-17 bombers, as did the 3rd Air Division. The 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberator. B-17 got a nickname as Flying Fortress because of the armament and firepower they had on the plane. They had 12 to 13 caliber, 50 caliber machine guns, excuse me. And there were three different models of B-17s flown in Europe. First of all, there was the E model, but they only made about 500 of those, so they were quickly phased out by the F model. And then in the fall of 1943, they started phasing in the definitive B-17, the G model, which you can always tell by the chin turret under the nose. Every plane we had a tail markings to identify them. Here you see the tail markings of the 306 Bomb Group, again the triangle of the 1st Air Division and the H of the 306 Bomb Group, so they were recognized as the triangle H. And then every bomb group had a aircraft number, which was assigned by the manufacturer. The Boeing company designed and produced 64% of the B-17s, but Lockheed Vega and the Douglas Aircraft Company also produced 18% as well. A B-17 could also take a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. Here you see the crew positions on a B-17. Again, this is the G model with the chin turret. Here up in the nose of the plane, you have the bombardier, the navigator, the two pilots, the flight engineer, top turret gunner, the bomb bay, radio operator, all turret gunner, two waist gunners, and then the tail gunner. Yeah, in the bomb bay, the bombs hung up on racks on each side of the plane, and then there was a 8-inch catwalk. It was really cramped in there. This boy's only 8 years old, so you can see how tight it was in there. And it wasn't uncommon during missions that these bombs would get hung up on racks, and that would require one of the crew to take a wrench and either knock the bomb loose or get it loose with his foot. And when these bomb bay doors are open on a mission, you're looking 5 miles straight down to the earth. So that took some courage and bravery to do that. This shows you the crew positions a little more closely. This is the F model without the chin turret. You have the bombardiers and the plexiglass nose. Of course, they needed to drop the bombs accurately. And then with the G model, he manned the chin turret when they were under attack. And then you had the navigator. He needed to know where they were and where they were going, and under attack, he manned chin turrets. There was cheek guns that were on each side of the plane. And then you had the two pilots. The first pilot, my dad, sat in the left seat. The co-pilot sat in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes, and not just because if one was injured or killed, you had another guy that could fly the plane. It was very stressful, both mentally and physically, to fly these planes. Back then, you actually had to fly them. It took a lot of muscle. And they were flying in these tight formations, and so they had to stay alert at all times, or else you could clip a wing on the plane next to you or run into the plane in front of you and go down. Then they had to fight the turbulence. Not only the air turbulence that anybody who flies a plane knows all about, but they had to fight the wake turbulence and the prop wash of all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. That would just turn the air up. And these missions were 6 to 10 hours in length, so it was very stressful. And the co-pilot flew the plane just as much as the pilot did. And then up above the two pilots, you have the flight engineer, top turret gunner. He manned the top turret when they were under attack. It's also called the crew chief. He knew how everything operated in the plane. And during flight, he would peer over the pilot shoulders to help monitor all the instruments in the cockpit. There were over 150 different goggles, gauges, dials that they had to look at, and the flight engineer would help monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. Then behind the bomb bay, you had the radio operator, where they had the most comfortable position in the plane. He had a fairly roomy compartment and a nice chair to sit on. And then the most cramped position on the plane, the ball turret gunner. Again, these missions were 6 to 10 hours long, and so he's in this fetal position for hours on end, which is very uncomfortable. And then up above the ball, you had the two waist gunners, which is the most positions which are most vulnerable. And then in the tail, you had the tail gunner. My dad flew his first mission on November 3rd of 1943 to Wilhelmshaven. And it was the first time that the 8th Air Force had put up over 500 bombers on a mission. Flying missions were absolutely brutal and extremely dangerous. There were 26,000 men that died in the 8th Air Force, which is more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either German fighters or anti-aircraft fire. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. At its height, there were about 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force located in the area of England called East Anglia, which was about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located just only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you had 100 of these bombers all taken off at the same time. And back then, they had no radar, no air traffic control. It was all based on visual sight. And usually the weather in England was overcast, just lousy at the time. And you couldn't see anything until you got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. And then they had to form up. Individual planes had to form up into three-plane elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions, and all this was before they could even start their mission over the English Channel. And this took an hour to 2 hours to do this. Then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or they'd soon pass out and be dead in a couple of minutes. And it was extremely cold at the altitudes that they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem, and many airmen were hospitalized for lengthy periods of time because of serious frostbite injuries. I know one of my dad's waist gunners, John Pindrock, was hospitalized for 2.5 months because of the frostbite injuries he suffered. Here you see the combat uniform. So this is a waist gunner. You have his steel helmet, tinted goggles because of the brightness of the sky, his oxygen mask. And then this is a flak jacket he's wearing. It's an apron that has metal plates in front and back to help protect him. And then it's fleece-lined jacket, fleece-lined pants, and thermal gloves, and boots. You see here the straps around his waist. That was his parachute harness. They didn't actually wear their parachutes in the plane because it was too cramped. B-17 was more cramped than a submarine. So these guys had to, if they needed to bail out, they had to have their wherewithal and wits about them to find their parachutes to begin with, and then clip it on hooks on the back of the parachute to bail out. Here you see the Nozard again. This is actually a B-24. The next thing they had to deal with was German fighter planes. Germany had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their air force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. Here again, you see a waist gunner with his oxygen mask and flak jacket firing his 50 caliber machine gun and all these spent cartridges down here on the floor of the plane. That's like trying to keep your balance, you know, stepping on ball bearings or marbles. And the ammunition of these 50 caliber guns came in belts, ammunition belts that were 27 feet long. So if he fired the whole belt, he said he fired the whole 9 yards. It was 8th Bomber Command's belief at the beginning of the war that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they flew what was called a combat box formation, the box of a combat wing. And then you can see within the box there are three additional boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each bomb group, you had three bomb squadrons. So the thought was that all this interlacing firepower could defend themselves and ward off the Luftwaffe. Here's another diagram of the formation from in front or back, and then up on top, and then from the side. They were three-dimensional formations. Unfortunately, there was no way that these bomber formations could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. Early part of the year, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Even though they implemented that mission limit of 25 in 1943, it was impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was only 6. And even when Bomber Command realized that they needed fighter escorts, the fighters at the time, Spitfires or P-38s or P-47s, didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way deep into Germany and then back again. They could escort them across the English Channel into France or the Netherlands, but then they'd have to turn around because they were running low on fuel and head back to their bases, while the Luftwaffe would just wait until they turned around, and then they would come swooping down on those bomber formations. The losses culminated in October of 1943 in what was termed as Black Week. In over four missions, 8th Air Force lost 148 bombers. That was almost 1,500 men. And the worst day was Black Thursday, October 14th, when 8th Air Force sent 291 bombers to hit the ball bearing factories in Schweinfurt, Germany, and 60 bombers were shot down. 17 additional bombers were so badly damaged they had to be scrapped. 10 of the 15 B-17s that the 306 bomb group sent up were shot down. Well, the 8th Air Force Bomber Command was in shock after this. There was absolutely no way they could sustain losses like that, and they seriously considered discontinuing daylight bombing. It wasn't until that external fuel tanks were added to the P-47 Thunderbolt and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang at the end of 43, beginning of 44, where these bomber formations finally had adequate escort support who could escort them all the way deep into Germany and escort them back. The P-51 Mustangs were really effective. By the time D-Day rolled around June 6th, they had virtually decimated the Luftwaffe, and they had gained air superiority. The next thing these bomber formations had to deal with was anti-aircraft fire. This is a flak gun. Flak was an abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. These were deadly weapons. They could fire 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bomber formations were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal called shrapnel that would burst out hundreds of feet when they exploded. And they could easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. They were so thin, you could just stick a screwdriver right through them. From a distance, they looked like innocent black puffs, but as these bomber formations got closer, those puffs got bigger, the explosions got louder, and once among them, the concussions of these exploding shells would just violently rock the ship. My dad said even though it was so cold at that altitude, he would be sweating profusely, and just his clothes would be sopping wet from the adrenaline running through his body. When the bombers got near the target, they reached a predetermined point called the initial point, the IP, then make a turn and they'd start their bomb run. At that point, the first pilot would give control over the plane to the bombardier, who would fly the plane through the Norden bomb site. It was tied into the autopilot on the plane. It was a revolutionary device. It was an analog computer that could calculate the speed of the plane, the speed of the wind, direction of the wind, altitude, so they could accurately drop the bombs successfully. And it was a highly secretive device. The bombardiers had to take an oath to guard this with their lives. Little did the U.S. know at the time, though, that before they even entered the war, that the Germans knew all about it. They had a spy in the Norden bomb site factory, Hermann Lang, that knew all about it and gave all the specifications to the Germans. Hermann Lang was eventually arrested in 1941 and spent 18 years in jail. Here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the Norden bomb site. And once he released the bombs, he would yell, "Bombs away!" And that would signal the first pilot to take control of the plane. And he'd make a big turn to get the hell out of there and go to another pre-designated point called a rally point, where the bombers that made it through the formation would try to form up and then get back to England, where once again they would have to face enemy fighters. Then once they reached England, they had a bunch of other dangers they had to deal with. A lot of times the weather would be crummy. They had a hard time finding their bases. They'd be running out of fuel. They'd have severely injured crewmen on board. And some of these planes would be heavily damaged and crippled from either the aircraft fire or the attack by the German fighters. And they'd have engines out, control shot out. You know, they couldn't, brakes that didn't work, landing gear didn't get down. So once again, you know, crash landings would occur and more airmen would die. I was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1943, where my dad's plane, the Susan Ruth, dropped its bomb successfully. But the bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed and they started falling behind the bomber formation heading back to England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, who, like wolves or lions, you know, came in and swooped down on their prey. In the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. The other eight airmen were able to bail out, but both those German fighters were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and he crashed and he died in his plane. The other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. One day when I was doing my research, my wife Glenda just casually said, "Well, why don't you try to find the German fighter that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking to myself, you know, she's naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. You know, it's just a ridiculous idea. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And I found out that not only did he shoot my dad's plane down, but the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans down. They shot each other down. And Hans gave me some wonderful information about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force in the book. After my dad bailed out, he came down in these trees. This is a picture that one of his Belgian helpers sent to him. As I mentioned, there's over 200 time period photographs. My dad came down in these trees, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he's dangling 20 feet off the ground, and he can't get down. Well, fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Henri Frank and Raymond Gervain, came to his rescue before the Germans could get there. This happened in the early afternoon. They went to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down a tree, and they told him to stay put and hide. They thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during daylight with these German patrols combing the area. Here you see Henri Franken next to the tree that they helped my dad down it from. Henri sent this to my dad after the war was over. That night, Henri and Raymond took him back to the Gravan farmhouse, and this is right at the French-Belgian border in the little village of Mackinois. The house is in Belgium, but those trees are in France, so you can see it is right at the border. He only stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilken, came in on a tandem bicycle to take my dad to a safer location. It was the middle of the night, pitch black. They headed out. My dad had shrapnel wounds in one of his legs, so he could only pedal the bike with his good leg. And they came to a hill, and they couldn't pedal up it anymore, so they started pushing the bike up the hill. And when they got to the top of the hill, they came to a little cafe. This is where it was located in. This picture was taken in 1994. But the lights were on. There was music playing, loud talking, laughter. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out with their arms around these two young girls. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around my dad and asks him for a light for a cigarette. Well, my dad's petrified. He doesn't know what to do. He can't speak German, can't speak French at the time. But fortunately, Paul Tilken understood, and he lit the guy's cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said they were too drunk, or as he termed schnockered, too interested in these two young girls to pay too much attention to two yokels that were pushing a bike up in the middle of the night. And after that, my dad was taken from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. Here you see my dad with some of his helpers. He had a lot of helpers. They put a beret on him and put him in civilian clothes, so he'd try to blend in, although he was so much taller than the local Belgians, that was problematic at times. And the people who hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of family and friends to help down airmen. If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they'd be arrested, tortured, neither sent to concentration camps or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew didn't meet that fate. Here you see a couple women that my dad spent a considerable amount of time with. On the left is Ghislaine Bayou. It was with her and her husband, Maurice, that my dad wrote his diary. And on the right is Jeanette Guidin. Her husband was a captain in the French army, and he was captured in 1940 when Germany first invaded Belgium and France. And he spent the rest of the war as a POW. It was very stressful for my dad, Heidi. Normally, the underground tried to get down to airmen back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, then into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. And it became real stressful. First of all, he was shot down, his plane's on fire, he has to bail out, he comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, can't communicate with the U.S. military, has no idea what happened to the other members, his buddies on the crew, being helped by people that are total strangers. They can't communicate because they can't speak each other's language. My dad did have a little French-English dictionary in his escape kit that he could refer to, and any of these people could be a collaborator and turn him over to the Germans. And there's a number of occasions that my dad was almost discovered while he was hiding that they're described in the book. One of those occasions when he was staying at Maurice and Ghislaine's Bayou's house in Charleroi. This is our house. And on one occasion, there was this loud knocking on the door, and Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof and he'd come back and get him once it was safe. You really can't see it from this angle, but up on the roof, there was an attic and a little tiny window that you can climb out. I've been in this house, been in that attic. And the roof is a tile roof. It's real steep. And it's scary. I'd be scared just to climb out that window and get up on that roof. Well, my dad spent all night there. Maurice never came and got him. And he said that the Germans didn't leave the area. They kept searching around. And Maurice thought it was too dangerous for my dad to come down. Finally, my dad got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies had landed in Normandy on June 6th. And he wanted to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, he had that year's infantry training. up in Washington, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he decided to join the French resistance, which is a very dangerous thing to do. But this is Amy Cools, another one of his helpers, who they rode bicycles and crossed over Belgium, across the border into France to join up with a unit of the French resistance. And the French resistance was called the Maquis. They were ragtag independent guerrilla groups located all across France. This isn't the unit my dad joined up with, but this gives you an idea that what they look like. Their mission or basically was to harass the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railway lines, attack convoys, assassinate German officers. And they got their instructions through the British, through coded messages over the BBC. And that's because the British had cracked the Enigma code, the German code, and knew what the Germans were up to. They were also supplied by the British through airdrops. And my dad said, you know, the information they gave was unbelievably accurate. If they told a convoy was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And there's a number of instances that are described in the book about encounters that my dad had with the Germans. This is the farmhouse that they stayed at just across the Belgian border into France, into Wallers, France. And this is another picture of the front. I took this picture of my dad in 1994, and he stayed up in this tower, these two little rooms up there. On one occasion, he was early in the morning, he was shaving, and he spotted a German convoy coming up the road toward the farmhouse. So he hightailed it to the back of the farmhouse. He had shaving cream on his face. He just had his skivvies on. And he dumped out these grain windows and hightailed it into the nearby woods so to avoid capture. There are about 20 men in his unit that was led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a prisoner of war camp, a German prisoner of war camp. They were made up of some Belgians, some Frenchmen, and also some Algerians that my dad said were vicious. This picture is pretty incredible. I don't know who took it or how it got back to my dad, but this is him jumping out of this jeep fighting with the French resistance. Finally, 7 months after its plane was shot down, word came that there are U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So my dad walked into the village, the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army that had come up through France after D-Day. He identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. And he caught a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, then hopped on a C-47 to get back to his base in England, where he sent a telegram to my mom saying he was fit as a fiddle and banked the money, honey, because they had all that back pay coming. Belgium is a very unique little country. A lot of people don't realize it's really divided in two. Upper portion of Belgium is called Flanders, where they speak Dutch or Flemish, and then the lower half is called Wallonia, where they speak French. And all really the story of the shot down story took place around here. Actually, my dad on the plane came down in Belgium, but the other guys that bailed out came down in France. Here at Charleroi, where my dad was hidden for quite a while. And then that farmhouse where the French resistance stayed in Trelon, France, where he was liberated, is just right around here. The Belgian people are wonderful people, and to this day, they are still so thankful and so grateful for the Allies coming to rescue them and liberate them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a wonderful job of educating the younger generations to remember the importance of those events. They've erected a number of memorials in the area where annually they have ceremonies to recognize the anniversary of those events. But the big ceremonies all occur around September 2nd, the liberation of Belgium. These celebrations last several days. This is a little poster from 70th anniversary in 2014. And they erect these big tents. This is just a portion of one that seats hundreds of people. And they're wonderful events. All the local villagers come out. They have band concerts, lunches, and dances, and dinners. They have a lot of reenactors that set up an army camp and have this vehicle parade. All the volunteers dress in period outfits, and the local beer chimney just flows, and everyone has a really swell time. But they do have serious ceremonies too. This is at a memorial in Sundron, Belgium, which is right at the French-Belgian border, where the U.S. 9th Infantry crossed over the Wartroz River to liberate the country. And again, all the local villagers come out, lots of military, the U.S. military, the Belgian military, the French military. All the dignitaries make speeches. And again, you can see all these young people here in the first row to begin to emphasize the importance of remembering these events. This is a memorial that they dedicated and erected to my dad and his crew in Mackinac, Belgium. It's about 200 yards from where the plane came down. On the front, there are two plaques that list the crew members' names, their ages at the time they were shot down, and their positions on the crew. Like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war until this memorial was erected in 1989. And my dad and the other three crew members that were still living went over for the dedication. And there my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war, saw all these places where it was hidden, and that brought it all back. And he started talking about it. And 5 years later, in 1994, was my first visit to Belgium. And that's when it became personal for me, because I saw all these places firsthand as well. I've been to Belgium 6 times. On two of those occasions, in 2016 and 2019, I traveled on to Munich, Germany. Whoops, I got ahead of myself. This is 1989, the dedication of the memorial. Here you see Paul Delahaye, who I mentioned earlier, that started the foundation. This is my dad. And these three people here were helped. This is Nellie Tilcan, who was the wife of Paul Tilcan, that customs officer. That's Nellie Tilcan. This is Jeanette Gadin, who I mentioned earlier. And then this is Raymond Dervan, one of those two Belgian men that helped my dad down out of the tree. As I was mentioning, on two of my occasions, I went on to Munich, Germany, where I visited a German pilot who shot down my dad's plane, Hans Berger. He lives in Munich, Germany. He's 97 years old now, and interestingly enough, he's the only person in the shot down story who's still living. Here you see me and Hans. He put on his flight jacket. I don't know if you can see this, but he's got his Iron Cross on there. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire. He was shot down 3 times himself. Most all of his friends were killed in the war. At the end of the war, he stopped flying combat, and he was a test pilot for the Henkel AT-162 single jet engine fighter, which never really saw it in the war. Then after we spent a couple hours at his home, this is 2019, and then afterwards we went to the Hofbrauhaus where we had a couple of beers. A lot of people ask me, well, don't you hate this guy that shot down your dad's plane? And no, I don't at all. I was so excited to find Hans. After all, the way I look at it, he was just a young guy, 19, 20 years old, trying to do a job like the U.S. airman, fighting for his country, trying to stay alive. Hans said it was too bad that they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. There was no other moment in my dad's life. It was the defining moment of my dad's life, World War II. And at one point in time, my dad's life and Hans' life intersected. So Hans is a part of my dad's life, a part of his story, and we become good friends. This is in 2019. I don't know when I get back to Germany to see Hans again, but I hope I do. You see my dad and myself at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. He wanted to see the memorial before he died. So I accompanied him to a reunion of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society in 2004, right before it was officially dedicated. And that was the last trip my dad ever took. He died in 2007 at the age of 91. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest. And virtually all the men who fought in World War II were in their mid-90s or older. At the end of World War II, there were 16 million World War II veterans. Now, this graph is a little outdated. As you can see, we're losing these men at a rapid pace. Today, there's only about 3% of these men still with us. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the world and America forever. The brave young men who fought and died for freedom are without doubt the greatest generation, and their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It is our duty to remember. Thank you.
Well, Steve, thank you for your presentation. And if anyone who's been watching has any questions for Steve, please just go ahead and type them in. We'll pick them up as they come in. But Steve, one of the things that struck me about this book, and we've talked several times through the years, is that you really not only did your dad's story and told you know what happened to him and some of the events that you've talked about tonight, but also you went back and researched all the other crew members as well, so you get a complete picture of everything that happened. And not everyone had the best outcome like your dad did. And what was the motivation that you had when you started writing the book? Obviously your dad was the foremost, but what made you bring the other stories into it?
Good question, Steve. Yeah, initially I thought, well, I'm writing a story about my book, but immediately I found out, oh, no, it's about each member of the crew. And more so than that, it's about all the men in the 8th Air Force, and really about a tribute to every man that served in World War II. As you mentioned, the book does go into what happened to each member of the crew. It's just not about my dad. And I just talked about my dad tonight. For those of you who want to know what happened to other members of the crew, you got to read the book. And as you alluded to, you know, some of those, their stories ended tragically, and others had happy endings. But something different happened to each guy. And that was, I think, so unique about it, as well as story of all those Belgian people that were involved in their lives and tried to help them to survive.
Yeah, that is another, it really struck me when I read the book, the dedication of the people in Belgium to hide these foreigners. And as you mentioned, under the penalty of death for for themselves, for the family, their friends, if they were found out by the Germans. And it's also incredibly heartwarming to know that they still have that thankfulness all these 76 years later for the American people.
Yes, absolutely. Dr. Paul Delahaye, he died in 2013, but his two daughters carry on his legacy today. And I've made some lifelong friends in Belgium, just wonderful people, and I love going over there. And it's amazing. Every time I go over there, I learn something new about the shot down story. It's incredible. Since I wrote the book, it changed my life. You know, I was just a retiree, and I wrote this book, and now all of a sudden, although not this past year, but normally I go all over the United States attending air shows, signing copies of my book, and do a lot of PowerPoint presentations to different organizations, which kind of curtailed. That's why we're doing these Zoom meetings now. But it has become my passion, and we can't let the memory fade. And I'm trying not to do that, or let that happen.
A couple of questions from some of our viewers. Have other people contacted you about getting your help researching their parents' story during World War II?
Yes, I am so blessed and fortunate to know so much about my dad and members of his crew. And I run into so many people that know very little or anything about their veteran, whether it's they're a son or a daughter or a cousin or a nephew. And that's a shame. But as I mentioned earlier, most of those guys just didn't talk about it. But people help me, and I try to help them out. There's, you know, various websites you can go to, and Facebook pages you can go to find out about your veteran. So I welcome anyone who wants to contact me and try to find out information about their vet.
All right. Let's see. Of the flight crew who survived being shot down, how many managed to get back to England at the end of the war?
Well, five made it back. Five did not. Two of my dad's crew are still are buried in England or Europe. One at the at Margroten in the Netherlands, and another crew member at Ardennes American Cemetery in Belgium. I've been to the American cemeteries in Europe. I've been to about five of them. They're wonderful places. A very tribute to the men who gave their lives.
One of our viewers wants to know if you're going to write another book.
Right now, I don't have any plans to. I did make a little 13-minute documentary on two of the trips over to Belgium. I went over with some camera crews, and we filmed hours and hours and hours of footage. And we were going to make a full-blown documentary, but that gets pretty pricey. So instead, we just did a little 13-minute documentary, and in hopes that maybe someone would be interested to make a movie out of it. But that's pretty remote, I think. But I do have a lot of footage. I do plan to make a documentary about all the footage that we filmed with Hans Berger and to tell his story. But it's a lot of work writing the book. I have people that ask me if I want to write this a book about their veteran, but I'm getting too old for that.
I'm sure it might be a bit of a challenge to write it, especially if you've read the book. You know that Steve, you wrote this with passion for your dad and for his crew and their entire story. So it might be difficult to muster up that same sort of energy behind a story that you're not as connected to.
True. As I mentioned, it took me 4.5 years to write this book. So I think I'm done. I'm just trying to keep the memory alive now.
Yeah, you did mention the documentary that is available out on YouTube.
Yeah.
And how
it's on my YouTube channel, Steve Snyder. It's also on my website, stevesnyderauthor.com. You know, most people buy the book on Amazon. You can get it on the CIF website. CIF sells it. If someone wants a personally signed hardcover copy, they can go to my website and order one there. One thing I'll mention about my website, too, is it's just not about the book. There's a tremendous amount of information that I put on the website about the air war over Europe, World War II. There's archival footage, links to all these different websites where you can want to do research for your veteran or other aspects about the air war over Europe. There's interviews with veterans, just a lot of information. Learn more.
Let's see. One more question. Are the photos that we see tonight, we saw in the PowerPoint, are those in the book? I know you mentioned there's about 200 other photos that are in the book, the printed version.
Right, and the printed version, there's only about 24 pictures in the ebook, but there's over 200 that are in either the paperback or the hardcover copy. And all the ones that I've showed tonight are all in there, plus lots and lots more.
Sounds good. Any final thoughts before we wrap up tonight?
Just a couple. One thing I'll mention that a lot of people don't realize that after my dad got back to England, he was sent back to the U.S. and became a flight instructor for the remainder of the war, because they had a rule that if you were shot down over occupied territory and aided by the underground, you couldn't go back into combat again, because they were worried that if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time you were shot down. And the only exception to that rule that I'm aware of is Chuck Yeager, who was shot down, and then he personally met with General Eisenhower and somehow talked to Ike into letting him go back into combat. A lot of people ask me if he got back in the war, but no, he became a flight instructor at Hendricks Field in Sebring, Florida, and also at Lockburn Air Force Base in Ohio before the war ended. So I just appreciate the opportunity to present tonight. Hopefully people enjoyed that. They'll be interested in reading the book. And thank you, Steve.
Yes. And we hope we will see you at an air show sometime later on this year as well. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us for a CAF Warbird Tube webinar. If you have any suggestions for any future topics or know of someone like Steve who might be of interest to our audience, please shoot Leah an email at media@CIFHQ.org. And we'll be back next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock Central Time. Until then, thank you to Steve Snyder for joining us. And for the Commemorative Air Force, I'm Steve Buss. Have a good night.